So we are finished with our introductory gambit, where we kind of surveyed the broad agenda of an emancipatory social science with a Marxian flavor, how to think about the overall architecture of this kind of theory. What we're going to begin today is the substantive discussion of particular concepts, particular parts of this theory that fit together then into the explanatory structure. And in particular, we will start a couple of weeks discussion of the concept of class. I thought I would begin as a prologue with just saying a little bit about my biographical connection to this concept, that is how I came to study class and how it sort of evolved in my own career as a sociologist. So the setting then, in the early 1970s, I was a graduate student at the University of California in Berkeley. I think I might have said a little bit about this in an earlier lecture. It was a particularly exciting moment in American universities in general. The student movement of the 60s really continues into the early 70s. So the 1960s begin about 1963 or 4. And they end about 1974. So, you know, we fetishize decades because of a numerological fixation, but the decade actually of the 50s doesn't end until sometime in the early 60s when the civil rights movement really and the freedom rides really kick off a new sense of momentum and dynamics. And it ends more or less with the end of the Vietnam War and the kind of buttoning down of American society in the aftermath of the oil crisis of the early 70s and things like that. So there was a sort of more or less a 10-year period. So the early 70s, very vibrant at the University of California. The faculty in the sociology department were completely dispirited, demoralized, disorganized, and absent. They abdicated their role more or less as serious mentors, and the department was in significant ways run by graduate students. We organized courses. This course is a direct descendant of a three and a half year course that just kept going, called Current Controversies in Marxist Social Science. We formed study groups. We had network associations with sociologists at Stanford and other campuses. We formed an organization of called the Union of Marxist Social Scientists, which had an annual conference that brought people from all over the West Coast. And all of this was done by students, mostly graduate students, but you know, undergraduates were involved in this stuff as well. Well, in that context, I was enmeshed in this sort of Marxian circle of radical intellectuals and was trying to figure out what I wanted to do my dissertation on. And wanted to do something that would have an impact in sociology as a discipline, but would also contribute to the development of a more potent and scientifically effective Marxism. And I decided in that context to kind of tackle a set of problems that were really at the core of sociology in those days, which was used to be called stratification. That term has kind of dropped off as it's not such a central term in sociology anymore, but it's basically studies of inequality. And the kind of core thing that sociologists did was to do multiple regression analyses of the determinants of status outcomes of various sorts, income being one, in which then the most common variable used to explain individual outcomes in income in the labor markets was occupational status. So I thought, okay, I was going to do a head-to-head combat between class and status as two different ways of thinking about inequality. that immediately meant I needed to find some data in which I could operationalize class. The theoretical problem of how to really nail down and think through the concept of class in a Marxian way was provoked by the need to actually use it in an empirical investigation. as opposed to in the first instance being driven by purely theoretical concerns. Because what happens is once you decide, okay, you're going to have a regression equation where you're going to have to take every person in your sample and put them in some, append to them a class variable, you have to think about, well, how am I going to measure it? And then you have to think about, well, what are the categories going to be? And that immediately provoked this problem, that the theory in the Marxian tradition was firmly grounded in a two-class model, capitalists and workers. That's where all the action is. It's true that if you read extensively in classical Marxism and in Marxist texts, there is discussions of other sorts of class categories, but it's helter-skelter, willy-nilly, pretty arbitrary, not very systematically. Someone counted, and in the 18th Brumaire, I think, of Louis Bonaparte, there's 17 different class categories talked about in passing, but none are given theoretical precision. You wouldn't know how to distinguish one from another, except just in ordinary language kinds of ways. And in the American sociological and cultural context, there's this looming category, the middle class. What do you do with it? So one simple solution is to say, let's stay at the high level of abstraction of the capitalist mode of production. Right? That's one solution. There are capitalists who own the means of production, and there are workers. All employees are workers, from high-level managers, except maybe, you know, once you get to the very top level of management in a big corporation where they also own stock, they become kind of quasi-capitalists. But aside from that very top layer, everybody's a worker, or a capitalist, or a residual category called the petty bourgeoisie, that is, people who are neither employers nor employees, they're self-employed. So you could stay at that high level of abstraction. That's the level of abstraction of discussing class structures at the mode of production. But if you're trying to explain income inequality in the United States, and you especially want to show that class is more potent than occupational status, that's a pretty lame approach, doomed to failure. You know that a continuous occupational status variable is going to be crude about it, is going to explain more variance than a dichotomy in which there's almost nobody in one category and 90% of the sample is going to be in another category. So that meant I had to grapple with the problem, how do we think through the concept of class at a lower level of abstraction than that very high, rarefied mode of production level? And that then opened up a kind of really interesting Pandora's box of problems. Meant I had to really think through what it means to move from one level of abstraction to another. What is this lower level of abstraction? How should we think about it? And how should we understand the categories? That's what then got me into this problem. That was, I suppose, my first foray into that was around 1973, probably. I finished in 1976. I did most of my work on this in 74 and 5. I did it collaboratively with a fellow graduate student, Luca Perrone, who was an Italian graduate student. We were really close friends. We published papers together in graduate school. He translated. I have some papers published in Italian that were never published in English because he translated them into Italian, and they got published in Italy, but not in the U.S. We worked really closely together, and as we were finishing graduate school, we were trying to think of what would be a project that we could do jointly that would enable us to keep seeing each other as we went off to our respective jobs. And the big class structure project, which got launched in 1978 after I came here, was really, to tell you the absolute truth, its primary initial motivation was just thinking about a project that we could continue collaborating with together. And we were kind of primed to do that because we had been working on all this stuff with class theory. So what ended up taking me 20 years, and I worked on that project till the late 90s, or really till the mid-90s, I suppose. You know, so a good 20 years, first half of my career, was motivated by large, to a significant extent, by non-academic concerns, wanting to have a way of having a close connection to my close friend. Well, that's how I got into it. I never dreamed when I started that I'd be working on that single concept so relentlessly for 20 years. Now, in retrospect, it was probably a very productive thing for me to be anchored in such a clear-cut problem with so many ramifications for that long, because you keep revisiting the same issues, and things that you thought were resolved unravel. And if you stick to it and you worry enough about it, and you take the problem of how do you nail down a concept seriously enough, it's possible actually to keep getting new layers of understanding in the course of that process. One of the tricks for me, in any case, was to constantly try to make as clear as possible what I wasn't satisfied with in the concept, rather than, as many people do, to try to make it seem at every step of the way that you know more than everybody else and you've got everything solved. And particularly there's a sort of French version of this, which is, I know absolutely what's right, and if you don't understand this, you're an idiot. You know, so it's a combination of self-satisfied projection, of self-satisfied certainty, and a preemptive effort to convince the reader that they are inferior, right? So that's one style of establishing your dominance. When I say it's distinctively French, it's a universal intellectual failure. I think that French sociology, French academic life, because of its particular hierarchical structures and cultural traditions, tends to have a higher dose of that kind of arrogant presentation of one's ideas than one finds in Anglo-American tradition, where there is more of a premium placed on clarity. And clarity means vulnerability. You know, that's the problem with clarity and its virtue. It means vulnerability. And this is sort of hard, especially for, I think, graduate students who feel vulnerable in more ways. It's good to be vulnerable. It's what you want. You want your ideas to be able to be subjected to the kind of criticism that will make you learn from the criticisms. And that means vulnerability. That's tough, though. You know, it's emotionally hard. All right, that's how I got into this. My own work has gone through a number of iterations. I have had at least two major different ways of thinking through this problem of what's middle about the middle class, how to think about it. We'll be discussing that problem in a couple of sessions. I've come to a kind of stable position on it. It hasn't changed again for the last decade or so. And I'm no longer working so intensively just on these ideas, so I doubt if I'm going to have some new epiphany and a new leap into a more refined concept. So what we want to do here is lay the basic groundwork, kind of survey the concept of class. What I want to do first is explore the many different ways that the concept is understood in sociology. So the word is used a lot in lots of different traditions. The word always somehow or other is about inequalities. Now, you know, literally the word class, it's a word that comes from classification. So you can talk about the classes of any sort. They don't have to be economically unequal categories. Class can be used, you know, to describe different kinds of fruit. You could have different classes of fruit. So in sociology, the word class always implies some kind of inequality of some sort or other. It is virtually always, although there's even some exceptions to this, a concept of inequality within which an economic dimension is pretty important, pretty central. Sometimes it's exclusively economic. Sometimes it's sociocultural economic. It's kind of interconnected clusters of elements that cohere. but they cohere around some kind of economic notion of inequality, one way or another, in virtually all uses. But there are endless debates and endless confusion about what exactly is meant by class. And one way that I've come to understand this variety of definitions is that they come from theoretical agendas that are anchored in different kinds of questions. So the way I've framed this, if class is the answer, what is the question? Now that formula, if X is the answer, what is the question, is a lead into various jokes. You know, if the answer is 9W, what's the question? And do you spell your name with a V, Mr. Weber? So it's no, W. Or if elementary, dear Watson, is the answer, what is the question? How much schooling did you have, dear Dr. Holmes, Mr. Holmes, elementary, my dear Watson? Okay, enough. anyway, if class is the answer, what is the question? And in my kind of attempt to consolidate the literature on this, and this is what the way I laid out that chapter in the Approaches to Class Analysis book, I've identified seven kinds of questions which sociologists ask about the world and in which their answers involve use of the word class. And the word class in such an answer then gets defined in different ways, in ways that are appropriate for the kind of question that's being asked. So just to kind of very briefly go through those, that this comes straight from that chapter, so this isn't new material. The first question is, how do people classify themselves in a system of social stratification? And one way people classify themselves is in terms of classes. So if you ask people the question, how are you located? What's your position in the society in terms of inequality? Some people will say, I'm working class, I'm middle class. Some people will say, I'm poor. Some people, almost nobody will say, I'm rich. That's just not an answer that people give to such questions. There's a variety of answers that people give to this question about subjectivity, their subjective location and their identity within a system of inequality, of economic inequality or stratification. So self-classification and subjective identity, that's one way that people think about the word class, how to use it in social theory. A second kind of question is how are people located objectively in distributions of material inequality? So this doesn't have to do with their subjective understanding, but just how would you position them? The usual way that class is used in ordinary speech by politicians today, when people talk about a middle class tax cut, all that's meant is a tax cut that will benefit people in the middle of the income distribution. It's a purely distributional use of the word class. There's a middle class tax cut, there's an upper class tax cut, there are not exactly lower class tax cuts that are ever advocated as such, and people don't use that expression, we want lower class tax cuts, but that is simply a class is being used to simply define where you're located in a distribution, usually of income or wealth. A more complicated concept of class asks the question, to what extent do different empirical dimensions of social inequality coincide in ways which constitute empirically distinguishable groups? So we have many dimensions of inequality: education, occupational status, income, wealth. You can think of others as well. A lot of dimensions of inequality. These could all be relatively independent of each other, just cross-cutting. Or they could cluster. There could be some coherence to these various dimensions. And to the extent there is coherence, then there are identifiable clusters, and these clusters can be called classes. Usually this approach to class, seeing class as simply a way of empirically summarizing a complex multidimensional space of inequality, usually this way of approaching it does not begin with any kind of inventory of classes. It says classes are merely inductively generated empirical summaries of the system of inequality. David Grusky, who is a well-known stratification sociologist at Stanford, does incredibly sophisticated quantitative work. This is basically the way he does class. He refers to these as little classes, as opposed to the kind of work that I do, which he calls big classes. And he basically wants to argue that there are hundreds of classes in the US class structure, because there are hundreds of well or reasonably well-bounded categories when you have a big multidimensional space in which you ask, how do things hang together? His work is interesting. I think it has very little to do with what's usually thought of as class. And his use of the word class comes very close to simply meaning group or category, because they're not even arrayed in a particularly hierarchical way. So although they're tapping into inequalities of various sorts, they are not themselves ordered in any space of inequality. They become ordered, they become just formed in a space of clusters rather than a space of inequalities. Now, as we move to the next set of categories, we're moving from less theoretically dense ways of understanding class to more theoretically dense ways, that is, intense ways, where there's more theoretical background to the production of the categories. The Weberian notion of class, what determines the basic life chances of individuals in a market society, that generates classes that are defined by the kinds of resources they bring to bear on market transactions. Since the resources actors bring to bear on market transactions determines their likelihood of success in those in markets. And that's the core of the Weberian kind of framework and approach to understanding class. The key idea there then is life chances. That's the kind of code word that's become standard within the Weberian tradition. Life chances often is taken to mean mostly mobility chances, but it isn't just mobility chances. It's chances for income and security, satisfactions of various sorts. And classes are an answer to that question. In a market society, the thing which determines your life chances is the resources, both the kind and amount of resources that you can bring to a market. And in Weber's view, there are three sorts of resources that really matter in markets. There's capital resources, there's skills, and there's labor power, just your ability to work. And these generate in the Weberian framework then the three basic classes of society. There is capitalists who bring capital to markets, there's workers who bring just their labor power, and then there's the middle class that brings skills. And that's not a bad point of departure. You know, I think you get a lot of action. And it has a certain Marxian flavor to it. And indeed, I think one can say that although in many sociological theory courses, Marx and Weber are treated as alternatives. You know, there's Marx, Weber, and Durkheim. Those are the three dead white men that are seen as the founders of different threads of sociological theory. With respect to class theory, Weber is actually quite Marxist in some ways. He's sort of a half Marxist. There's ways in which he's not, but I think it's his work has a quite Marxian character to it. There's an interesting book that Weber wrote. I like to describe this as something he wrote before he was Weber. So Weber's biography, he was a kind of prodigy intellectual in the 1880s, and well, not in the 1890s, and then he had a complete mental breakdown. He was the son of one of the richest families in Germany, you know, super wealthy, global capitalist family. He had a mental breakdown. And the Weber we know and read was the Weber of that was the things he wrote after he recovered from his several years out of action because of his depression. But he wrote a book that was published based on his dissertation, which was about the decline of the Roman Empire and the collapse of slavery, of the slave economy in the late Roman Empire. And if you read that essay, it's a long, very interesting piece. If you read it and you didn't know who wrote it, you know, if this was a kind of homework assignment, read this and describe the intellectual formation. One would say, well, this has a kind of late 19th century feel to it. It's written by some very interesting Marxist who's trying to grapple with the historical case of the decline of the Roman Empire and clearly has a strictly materialist account rooted in the contradictions of slavery as a mode of production, because the key to his argument is that once the Roman Empire cannot expand further because it hits the barbarian frontiers and can't bring slaves from outside, then the slave estates have to reproduce themselves by producing slaves on the estate, as opposed to capturing slaves. Once you start producing slaves on the estate, you have to cover the costs of children. And you have to start allocating more of your estate resources to the task of producing your labor power, rather than having every laborer coming full-formed as an adult. And that creates an inward orientation of the estate economy towards its own reproduction, rather than an outward orientation towards its connection with military power, which was its previous relationship. And it changes the whole social structure of the relationship between the Roman state and the great landowners, who become more autonomous, kind of almost mini-states of themselves, because they have more tasks to accomplish and less interlaced with the imperial project of the Roman state. Well, you know, it may or may not be a good account of what unravels in Roman times, but it has a very Marxian flavor to it. All right, that's number four. Number five is, what forms of conflict are most systematically linked to the social organization of production? So if you think we've got this social, by production I really mean the social organization of the whole economic structure, but understood as a structure that doesn't just exchange things but produces things. When the term word production is invoked in Marxism, as opposed to just markets, it's not meant to be production instead of markets. It's supposed to be the economic system understood as a system that actually does things rather than just exchanges things. But it also exchanges things. So the notion of mode of production doesn't imply that you ignore how things get distributed. It's just that things have to get produced before they're distributed. And so it's understanding that there's an actual material process of activity that's generating the goods and services, which then are exchanged in markets. Markets are still absolutely central to a notion of mode of production. It's just that they're not disengaged from the production process. So class is one answer to the question, what forms of conflict are most systematically linked to systems of production? Well, class conflicts are the kinds of conflicts that are linked to the way you organize production in the society. The sixth question, how should we characterize and explain variations across history in the social organization of inequality? So if we want to look across the vast array of types of society historically, and it can be synchronously, that means at one point in history the variations across places, but across time and place, how should we characterize and explain the variations across history? Well, one way of doing that is to look at the variations in the way systems of production are organized, or class, as an answer to the question, how should we characterize and explain variations? And finally, there's the question, what sorts of transformations are needed to eliminate economic oppression and exploitation within capitalist societies? What kind of transformations do we need to strive for if we're going to eliminate the economic forms of oppression and exploitation? What do we have to change? Class is an answer to that question. It doesn't say that the only thing that has to be changed in order to accomplish this is class. It's silent on the question of whether transforming, for example, gender and race as part of the process through which one would transform class relations. But it is saying that if we're in a capitalist society and you want to eliminate economic oppression and exploitation, the key problem is how do you transform the class structure. So different traditions of class analysis typically bring into alignment and connection more than one of these questions. There are some sort of particular projects that might be exclusively anchored in one or another of these, but more typically, clusters of these questions get linked together. And what we would think of as a tradition of class analysis is really a package of several of these questions. Thus, for example, some traditions of class analysis are concerned about the relationship between, on the one hand, the objective properties of a person within a system of inequality, which could be number two or three on this agenda, and their subjective states understood in terms of identity, lifestyles, and tastes, which is more connected to the first. So you often get numbers one and two or one and three sort of clustered together. This is how I would think of Bourdieu's class analysis. It's kind of a combination of the notion of subjective location and identity with the class as an empirical summary of stratification with a bit of class as a market opportunity structure. There's a recent British study called the Great British Class Survey, which has gotten a huge amount of play in Britain, which adopts really sort of fancy formal statistical classification algorithms to group people into classes. And their question is, how many classes are there in Britain today? And what they grouped, what they did in their grouping were occupation, wealth, income, and then a variety of lifestyle indicators. Sort of, and that's what gives it this sort of Bourdieusian flavor, things that are connected with taste. And they ended up with seven classes. Their seven classes are the elite, the established middle class, the technical middle class, new affluent workers, traditional working class, emergent service workers, and the precariat. In contrast, Marxian class analysis is mainly rooted in the last three of these questions. And I think ultimately the seventh question is the anchor. That's what drives it. That is, the purpose of class analysis is to solve the problem of class emancipation. You need a concept that is rich with the emancipatory problem. And that leads to a concept which also taps into historical variation and conflict. But it's really the emancipatory problem which roots it. And that's why emancipatory categories relevant to emancipation, like exploitation and oppression and domination, figure so centrally in the Marxian form of class analysis. Okay, that's one way of mapping out the terrain of the use of class throughout different traditions of class theory, mapping it out by the concepts, by the questions that are being asked. A second strategy, which is in the New Left Review article, is to see, as a result of all those different questions that get asked, what research has actually identified are different clusters of real mechanisms that operate in the world. And to then try to ask the question, how do these different mechanisms fit together? So different class theories, different traditions of class, should not be viewed as opposed to each other. They're just different. They're identifying different causal processes. But these different causal processes fit together. We live in a world where there's multiple causal mechanisms operating. Lives are shaped by how these intersect each other. And what a more comprehensive class analysis would do is include all of this. And that can be done as a laundry list. You know, sometimes multiple regression equations have dozens of variables and just you throw everything in the kitchen sink in it. Or it can be done in a more coherent way. You try to ask the question, how do these actually fit together in a coherent manner? And that's what I tried to do in that paper that's called Understanding Class Towards an Integrated Class Analysis. I won't go systematically through that paper. I think it's pretty clear, and we can discuss it in our discussion after 11. Just let me summarize the central ideas. In that paper, I identify class with three different clusters of mechanisms. The first are mechanisms that are attached to persons, that we can call these individual attributes. So people have attributes, and they individually have material conditions of life, which you can think of these, the attributes, as the characteristics that individuals take with them, and the individual material conditions of life are their attributes that they have at any given moment in time. So individuals have these attributes, and we can list them, and these attributes are consequential for various things. In class analysis, the kinds of attributes that matter the most are things like your social background. Those are attributes. You've got a background. You can't change it. You can overcome it. You can add new experiences, new capacities. But people have social backgrounds of various sorts. They acquire education, and the education or skills or knowledge, however you want to think about it, human capital is a common way of talking about this, become embodied. You carry it with you. And you have income, which enables you to do things. So these are clusters of attributes that are tied to individuals. Well, that's one set of mechanisms. The key idea here is that the mechanisms are connected to the person. The other two clusters of mechanisms are mechanisms connected to positions occupied by people. The people can come and go, but the mechanisms remain the same. That's a really important distinction to try to get your head around. The idea, and we'll discuss this a little bit more when we get to the step-by-step guide to the Marxian concept of class. It's a tricky idea, the idea that there are actually positions in a society that people fill. One way of thinking about this is if you really take that idea seriously, there are positions in a society that are unfilled. Sometimes people call those empty places. The most familiar kind of empty place is a job opening, right? So that's a kind of straightforward example, right? There's a employer, there's 100 jobs in the firm, and there are 92 people employed there. There are 8 job openings. Those are empty places that will be filled by persons. The attributes of persons may explain why they end up in those places, but the places have attributes themselves. Independently of who ends up there. So whether it's a lottery and people get there randomly, or it's a highly meritocratic, carefully selected process by which people get into those positions, the positions have attributes. And you can build a concept of class around the mechanisms, the causal processes, derived from the fact that the positions themselves contain, embody causal properties. Some positions, for example, into which you might be randomly sorted or highly selectively sorted, you know, either way. Some positions have the property of allowing the person in those positions a huge amount of autonomy to do what they want. Other positions allow virtually no scope for individual autonomy. That's not a characteristic of the person, it's a characteristic of the position. So that's some, and this gets to the kind of core of a lot of sociological thinking in general, not just Marxian sociology. The notion that the structural positions that the society makes available into which people live their lives, the positions themselves have consequences, meaning they have properties that shape people's lives. Well, the next two sets of mechanisms both concern the nature of the properties of the positions themselves. One set of properties of positions has to do with how the position recruits people into it. What are the mechanisms connected to that position which exclude people or include people? And the term that's been used by some people who focus on that is opportunity hoarding. Opportunity hoarding is a property of positions. So, for example, when a position requires people to have a credential, you can't get into that position unless you have a credential. That restricts some people from getting into the position. You can't get that job unless you have a credential. The credential is something that the individual has, but the restriction of the job to people with a credential is a property of the position. It's a way then of restricting or hoarding the opportunity. I think that's the way Weberian tradition, that's one way of thinking about what property rights are. So the position of the owner of a factory is restricted to people who have a particular kind of credential, namely ownership of the means of production. If the workers take over the factory and say, no, we run this thing, we own it, well, they'll find out they're mistaken. There are mechanisms in place to exclude them from the position of directing the factory and appropriating the fruits of labor of the workers within the factory. The mechanisms are enforced by the police, but it's really what we mean by the position of owner. And the opportunity hoarding property is then enforced by the state, just as the opportunity hoarding property of credentialed jobs is enforced by various legal rules. Property rights are a way of excluding people from access to certain kinds of positions in society. That's what property rights do. They accomplish that quite successfully. Opportunity hoarding, therefore, refers to the various mechanisms connected to positions which include and exclude people from access to those positions. The third set of mechanisms, classes, exploitation, and domination, describe attributes of positions that govern the behavior of people once they are inside of the position. So the opportunity hoarding is about access to positions. Properties of positions that determine access is the door open or closed, and what's the mechanism that opens it or closes it. What class as exploitation and domination identify are what happens to people once they are in positions. Domination is a description of a relationship between people within a structure once they are in the position. Bosses tell workers what to do, workers follow orders. Exploitation is a description of what happens to people once they are in the positions. Workers work, and the fruits of their labor are appropriated by exploiters. They don't take home what they produce, someone else does, and they get paid for doing so. These are all mechanisms which impact the lives of people. It's not false that the human capital you acquire matters. It's not false that your cultural capital matters. I mean, these kind of individual attributes things. These things do matter in the lives of people. It's just incomplete. It's not an adequate account of the total set of mechanisms that shape the way people's lives operate within structures of inequality. The individual attributes are only part of the story. One illustration I use sometimes to really make it kind of clear how the difference between individual attributes and structures as explanations and why an individual attribute account is incomplete. This comes from a book called On Explanation by a philosopher named Garfinkel. I forget the first name. It's an example that he uses. So imagine a course in which we want to explain why some people get A's and some people get B's and some people fail. Okay? We want to explain the grades that people get. And we very accurately measure. So there's no measurement problem here. The amount of effort people performed in the class and the amount of raw intelligence they have. And we have this theory that, and these are both individual attributes, right? How much effort you perform is how much effort you perform. How your raw intelligence is an attribute that you have. Even if it may be socially shaped, it's still the attribute that you embody. And you measure these really accurately, and lo and behold, you have a perfect prediction. You can actually predict, on the basis of effort and intelligence, every single person's grade in the class. And you say, aha, we've now explained it. The smartest people who worked the hardest got the best grades. The people who screwed around or were less capable. And there's some weight to these things, and they interact. You know, you've got a sophisticated interaction model between effort and intelligence. And you've accurately predicted every person. The question is, have you therefore explained the distribution of grades? And the answer is, in most contexts, no. Or in many contexts, no. You haven't explained anything about the distribution of grades. You've only explained why people end up within that distribution. Because imagine the professor has the following grading scheme. I'm going to give 1 A, 3 Bs, 10 Cs, and everybody else fails. And that's set by administrative fiat. Power determines the distribution entirely. And the performance of the individual attributes only explains how people end up in a distribution which is caused by processes completely independent of the attributes of persons. So if you want to explain the distribution, you don't have to make reference to the attributes of persons at all in this particular story. They are irrelevant. That's what we call a grading curve. Grading curves sometimes are vicious, sometimes they're gentle. Since there's always some kind of standard that's imposed by authority with respect to what, even if it's not a curve, even if it's just a threshold model, that's still something being determined independently of the effort and ability of the persons. So this, the analogy then with respect to income distribution or poverty, there's a temptation in much sociology and even more so in economics to explain poverty on the basis of deficits in the attributes of poor people. Why are the poor poor? Because they lack human capital. That's it. Why do they lack human capital? Well, maybe it's because they have a disorganized family or they have a set of cultural dispositions. There's other explanations for the lack of those individual attributes. But you got a bunch of social explanations of the individual attributes, but the individual attributes explain the poverty. And a classic kind of example that would be used, you can have a family with two brothers and one succeeds and one stays poor. It's a poor family. And you want to explain why one succeeds and one doesn't. And you naturally are drawn to an explanation about the difference between them, individual attributes. But how much poverty there is in a structural account is not a function of the distribution of attributes. It's rather a function of the structure of positions. Now, in a pure structural model, which would be like my grading example, individual attributes don't affect the structure. right? So the professor has set this grading scheme, and no matter how hard everybody works, only one person is going to get an A. So the structure is impervious to individual attributes. In a pure individual attributes model, the structure is entirely generated by the attributes of persons. It just mirrors whatever those attributes are. That's the pure economist's human capital model. In fact, in reality, these things interact. The nature of the positions that are available will be influenced by the attributes of persons in the simple sense that capitalists are more likely to create certain kinds of jobs knowing that there are certain kinds of attributes likely in the environment. So it is true. It is, unlike the professor who by fiat just creates the grade structure, capitalists will respond to some extent to the attributes of persons in designing jobs. That means that you can't say that the structure of positions, the nature of these positional mechanisms, are completely independent of the distribution of attributes. There's some kind of dynamic interconnection. That makes this a super hard problem. You can see why. If you have that kind of dynamic interaction, it's a super hard problem to really nail down the evolution of structural positions and the evolution over time or change over time of the distribution of attributes. Super hard problem to disentangle these. But the key idea in the, certainly in the Marxian and Weberian tradition, is however hard it is to disentangle them, there's significant autonomy to the power relations over the nature of the positions themselves that is not reducible to the attributes of the persons that fill those positions. And that's the key idea. And that's what the second and third of these clusters of mechanisms do. Okay. Let me quickly run through this step-by-step guide for the conceptual foundations of the Marxist class concept. I've tried to decompose, you know, the where you end up with in a Marxian concept, to break it down to its to each of the kind of logical steps that you need to understand what kind of concept this is. And I think it's probably worthwhile going through this rather than saying let's just end at 11, because I don't think the step-to-step guide as such is in the readings in this form. So this is a new gloss on these issues. So let me just run through this and then we'll take our break. Okay, step one is to understand something we've already talked about, and that's the distinction between a relational and a gradational concept of class. So gradational is anchored just in the individual attributes. You can measure something on the individuals, and then you can just rank them from bottom to top. You can measure their income, and class is just more or less of this attribute. That's gradational concepts of class. A relational concept of class means that class is rooted in the idea of a social relation. Relations are attributes of positions, not persons. You cannot define one part of one person's position without also defining another. You cannot define the category slave owner. It's a meaningless category without the category slave, right? So the very definition of a slave owner invokes a relationship to another category. The same is true for capitalists. You cannot define a capitalist without also defining a worker. You can't define a feudal lord without defining a serf. The very concept involves a relation to someone else. So the first point about the Marxian concept is it's a relational concept. That's why the names of classes are not high and low and middle. The names are qualitative. Lord and serf, those are names, they're attributes of roles rather than just more or less of something. The second step is to figure out, well, what kind of relation is a class relation? There's lots of relations in the world, lots of kinds of relations. There's gender relations, race relations, friendship relations, those are relations, social relations, and class relations. What kind of class relation, what kind of a relation is a class relation? And here there's really two ingredients. The first, you have to understand the notion of relations of production. The relations of production are the social relations into which people enter in order to set in motion a process of production. Assets have to be deployed in production. You need tools, raw materials. Any kind of production has some kind of asset. This deployment of these assets could be defined in strictly technical terms. That's called a production function. So you can say for any process of production, you need so much wood and so many saws and so much human energy. You know, you could just define the technical inputs and how they fit together. Or you can define the process of production, how all these inputs get combined, in terms of the rights and powers of actors over all of these inputs that go into production. Rights and powers over the inputs are what we mean by the relations of production. Just one little point of clarification here. The right and power a person has over the means of production is really a claim about the social relationship between that person and other people. It's not a description of your physical strength to be able to pick up or not the means of production. It's rather a description of your ability to exclude other people from using it. What it means to own a tool is to have the power to decide who uses it. So rights and powers over these inputs is a description of the relationship among the people engaged in using the inputs. That's the relations of production. Relations of production become class relations when these rights and powers are unequally distributed. They're not class relations if the rights and powers are equally shared, if they're held in common by everyone. They're production relations, but we would call that a classless production relation if everything is held in common. You could say it's a particular form of class relations, namely the classless form of class relations. Well, that, you know, the words get a little jumbled when you talk about a classless form of class relations. So we typically, the convention in the language is production relations become class relations when the rights and powers over the inputs in production are unequally distributed. Okay, that's the second step. That distinguishes class relations from gender relations. Gender relations are not about rights and powers over means of production. They're about rights and powers with respect to the roles of men and women, which in turn may be connected to class relations. So it may be that there are forms of gender relations which are deeply connected to class and forms which aren't, but it's about relations of gender rather than relations over the organization of production. Step three, understanding variations in class relations. So the key idea here is that there are qualitatively different kinds of class relations, not just one. It's not just once you've understood that class relations are unequal distributions of rights and powers over the inputs to production, that that's the end of the story. No, there's many different ways that these rights and powers can be distributed. And in particular, and this is a really crucial idea, there are big differences in what people are allowed to own. So the simplest example of this is the contrast between capitalism and slavery. In slavery, people are allowed to own people. In capitalism, they're not. Capitalism is a radically egalitarian system of production with respect to property rights in one crucial asset, people. Everybody owns one, so to speak. Everybody owns themselves. Self-ownership is one way that this is described. There are philosophical problems with the idea of self-ownership. We don't have to worry about that here. But it's a pretty simple point, I think. In capitalism, everybody owns themselves. You decide. You have the rights and powers to decide how to deploy your labor power or not to deploy it at all. Now, you may be miserable if you don't deploy it, but still, nobody owns you. In slavery, people own each other. Yeah?
Is that account for, say, family businesses where kids work for the parents?
Well, so there are particular case, there are particular shadowy areas. Do we? There's a debate over whether the right way of thinking about parental rights over their children is that they own their children. They don't really have full property rights in their children. They can't sell them.
No.
So if
but
you
they can relinquish rights and give the state rights.
Right. So, but they still can't. You know. So I don't think that the language of ownership is the most helpful way of understanding. The way parents, they dominate their children, but they don't own them. And there are restrictions on family businesses, on what parents can demand of their children, which means that the state interferes and blocks that domination in certain respects. But there are shadow areas, for sure. So, one way of thinking about feudalism, it's another form of class relations, is that feudalism is a system of rights and powers over the inputs and production, where there is joint ownership of the labor power of peasants. The peasant's labor is jointly owned by the lord and the peasant. So that, you know, in classical feudalism, the peasant works a certain number of days a week on his or her own land and a certain number of days a week on the land of the feudal lord. That's one form that feudalism takes. If the peasant runs away to the city and the sheriff of Nottingham goes off and brings him back to the feudal estate, what the peasant has done by running away to the city is stolen something from the lord, namely the lord's rights to part of the labor of the peasant. So you can think of capitalism as an egalitarian system with respect to the ownership of people. Everybody has one unit. Feudal slavery as a radically inegalitarian system. Some people own many and some people own none. And feudalism as a kind of joint stock company in the labor power of people. There's joint ownership of the labor of people. Well, each of these are variations. They create a wide range of different kinds of class systems. And they each of these systems pose specific problems for how do you maintain the class relations, what kinds of enforcement mechanisms are needed, and so on. That's step three. Step four. Once you've defined these class relations, you then have to think about the problem of locations. So once you've got a structure of relations, then we can look at how people are located with respect to those relations. In the simplest way of thinking about relations, relations are binary. You have capitalists and workers, and people therefore are located in one or another of these positions. This is where things will get more complicated when we move to lower levels of abstraction, because we'll see that these relations in capitalism are way more complicated than simple binary relations. And that's because this simple abstract description, some people own and control the means of production and other people do not, doesn't accurately describe how production is actually organized. And we will see ways in which complexity occurs once we look at in a more fine-grained way at the nature of relations in the actual organization of production. But the problem is still, how do we define class locations within relations? Step five is thinking about the micro and macro levels of analysis. So micro and macro is different from concrete and abstract. Those are different ways of thinking about concepts. Micro and macro refers to units of analysis. Abstract and concrete refers to how simplified and abstracted from complexity your account is of any unit of analysis. The macro concept of class refers to the totality of class relations within some unit of analysis. So you can talk about the class structures of countries, of cities, of corporations. You could talk about the class structure of the world. You can take any unit of analysis, any scale unit of analysis. It can be a well thought out unit. Countries are pretty reasonable units because they're bounded by political jurisdictions. Regions are a little fuzzier because there's no natural boundary to a region. But sometimes it's very useful. And you could talk about the class structure of the South and the class structure of the upper Midwest, for example. But that's a little vaguer because there's not exactly a bounded character to it. But you can also talk about the class structure of a particular firm. Some firms have different class structures. That's the macro level. Class structure of some unit of analysis. The micro level concerns the impact on the lives of persons living within a class structure. That's the micro level, is the impact on the lives of actual human persons. And these impacts occur through two broad classes of mechanisms, through experiences and through interests. Experiences refers to what happens to you by virtue of being in a class location. All sorts of things happen to you when you're in a given class location. You suffer, you or don't in particular ways. You're bossed around and frustrated and angry, or you're doing the bossing around. I mean, there's all bossing around is an experience. You are getting people to do things they don't want to do. You have to behave in a particular way. And that can create all sorts of stress, for example. Supervisors are often the most stressful positions. It's often easier and less stressful to be bossed around than to be a low-level boss in a job. Low-level bosses get yelled at from above and get angry responses from below. They're just super stressful. Those are experiences that happen by virtue of your location within a class structure. But you also have interests. We will talk a lot about the concept of interests when we talk about exploitation on Tuesday. Interests tell you what you have to do to meet your material needs because of your class position. Your interests, what we mean by interests are, given your class position, what do you have to do to get what you need? Interests are a description of the strategic context of your actions, what you have to do to get what you need. Step six. I call these the fundamental thesis of class analysis. There are these theses of class analysis. Should be plural. There are these three claims that are bound up with all relational class analyses of one sort or another. First, what you have determines what you get. That's the Weberian life chances point. What you have determines what you get. Second, what you have determines what you have to do to get what you get. So it's not just that an input-output thing. What you have determines what you get as a black box. And the black box is what you have to do, given what you have, to get what you get. That's entering the market and entering positions that involve opportunity hoarding and the like from the Weberian point of view. And the third thesis is what you have to do to get what you get, that is what you have to do actually in that process, determines whose interests are opposed to your interests. Who are you in conflict with? And that invokes the exploitation and domination dimensions in the Marxian framework. And then finally we get to the Marxian class analysis itself, which identifies the specificity of class mechanisms, the actual mechanisms, causal processes involved in what you have determines what you get, what you have determines what you have to do to get what you get, what you have to do to get what you get determines whose interests are opposed to your interests. Those three little slogans. They get increasingly less like bumper stickers. And, you know, what you have determines what you get. And what you have determines what you have to do to get what you get. Well, that's a kind of little long bumper sticker. The last one loses its bumper stickerish quality. And the two big concepts that we will be exploring that I think are really the guts of the Marxian mechanisms are exploitation and domination. Exploitation is a way of talking about how the interests of people within class relations are antagonistic. Exploitation is a particular way of understanding conflicts of interest, antagonisms of interests. And domination is a way of talking about how people's lives are controlled. It's about talking about how activities are controlled. You can have domination without exploitation. You can control the lives and activities of people without exploiting them. But exploitation always entails at least indirect domination. You can't have exploitation without domination, but you can have domination without exploitation. And that's all going to get clarified next week. Finally, I'm not going to go through this list of the repertoire of class concepts. We'll be discussing all of these in turn in the course of the next few weeks. What I do want to emphasize is in all of these expressions under Roman numeral 5, class is an adjective rather than a noun. And I actually think class is more useful as an adjective. That is, mostly in class analysis, one talks about class conflict, class locations, class relations, class structures, rather than classes. There's a certain kind of uncomfortable reification or something that goes on when you talk about the working class. It's not as clear a concept than talking about working class locations within a class structure or class struggle or class struggle involving workers and capitalists. The working class is a more troubled concept. I mean, I use it too. I'm not saying you can't use it. But most of the analytical work of class comes through its use as an adjective with respect to structure, interest, formation, capacities, practices, struggle, and consciousness, to list the ones here. Okay, well, that was longer than should have been perhaps, but we got through this stuff. Let's take a 10-minute break and start promptly at 11:25.